We are talking once again with Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Oh, good stereo on that one.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Good to
No,
have
no,
you.
We cannot harmonize.
Oh, please, I won't. I won't ask you to.
No.
All right. So, starting out, before we get to local, passing of a very notable person.
Yeah, last weekend, Thich Nhat Hanh, I think that's how you pronounce his name, Buddhist monk and apostle of nonviolence, passed at age 95 last weekend. He is pretty much single-handedly responsible, I think, for Western Buddhism. Very popular, a lot of popular books in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and even recently. You know, very, very much an advocate of nonviolence. Inspired a lot of people. So he had a long, full life. He's, living as something else now, I guess. He will be missed for sure.
All right, so starting out with local, and article in the Seattle Times about a Redmond police officer.
Yeah, Jim Bruner dug into this. He was on the violin anyway. He's one of the Times' few remaining experienced reporters. And he found that a guy named Daniel Mendoza, Redmond police officer who shot and killed Andrea Cherna in November of 2020, as she was unarmed and lying on her front porch, she was having a mental health crisis, and for some inexplicable reason, he shot her. She was unarmed, as I said. He had been dismissed from a probationary period as a Whatcom County Sheriff's Officer only 14 months prior, and had it had really been a favor to the Whatcom Sheriff's Department that he was allowed to pass the police training academy in the first place. Then when they fired him, they said he was deficient in nearly all areas of policing. Does not seem to have been very bright or a very quick learner. So this raises the question of why he was on the Redmond police force, and you know what happened to the I guess it predated the legislative fix where you know, at least there's a database for different departments to check to see if you've been fired with cause from a previous department. He should never have been hired in the first place. There's no way that Redmond would not have known both of this academy performance and his being fired from Whatcom. But he managed to get hired, and then he went out and shot and killed a woman for no apparent reason.
I think it depends on what the hiring process is in the Redmond Police Department. You have to do background checks. You know, you have to do reference checks. You have to do searches to see if people have been involved in misconduct cases in other police departments before you just accept what they put on their resume and say, yeah, we're desperate for people. You have experience. Well, you got a job, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think that points out that issues with police accountability are not just inner city issues. You know, some of our suburbs are also struggling with that and having the same kind of bad things happen.
Yeah, ask Kent.
So, yeah, I mean, looking at the hiring practices for the different entities in our area would seem to be something of value mm-hmm. for the community.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, just having the state database, just having a state agency that oversees this and that collects information and provides it to, or is willing to provide it to other policing and security agencies around the state is just one step. The other step is requiring police departments to do this kind of a search before they hire someone to look at that database and to make sure that they reference check and that there are no issues like that with the candidates that they're hiring.
And you know, some level of accountability would be nice too, because of course, until the Times investigated it, and you know, you have to wonder why they were tipped onto this particular use of lethal force, whether somebody in the department tipped them onto it, or you know, the family or somebody else. But you know, if they can figure it out, then an agency can certainly figure it out. So, yeah, this is not a good scene. Yeah. And you wonder whether also King County Prosecuting Attorney Dan Satterberg will take an interest in this case now.
It also brings up, you know, the fact that with, like, taking Seattle Police Department as an example, that with all these, they were talking about, you know, the numerous departures of police officers for various reasons, that, you know, these guys are then going on to other, obviously they're probably sticking with police departments and getting hired in other police departments. And there's appears to be like little or no tracking where potentially bad cops, they're saying, oh, it's okay, 'cause the person quit the force. And then, you know, yeah, but he's getting hired somewhere else.
Well, and the lack of speed in investigating these things in the Seattle Police Department. I mean, it's one of the things people point out, you know, why does the OPA sit on these? They make these findings, but they don't release them for months. And that allows the person in the department who would have been disciplined to leave and go get a job somewhere else. And there's nothing on his record to stop him or her from getting that job in another police agency because the OPA hasn't issued their ruling, you know?
So the ones that scare me are the ones who left because they didn't want to get vaccinated, because they still want to be cops, probably.
Yeah. And they still want contact with the public, including in emergency situations with people who are having health crises already. And, you know, they're walking around spreading COVID.
Yep. Typhoid officer for friendly.
Yeah.
So we're starting the show off with some feel good items.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of police accountability, this week, you know, the city council is starting to ramp up their city council meetings. And, this week, the, public safety and, human services committee met. I believe it was on Tuesday. I went back and I listened to the video because this was the week when, there were a couple of presentations on a couple of important reports by on police accountability. Most of the meeting was taken up by two reports on police reform. The first was the police monitor, Antonio Oftili, talking about his report on SPD's crisis intervention performance. That's how SPD officers respond to events where a person or persons are in health or mental health crisis.
Why are they still responding to mental health calls? I don't understand that.
Yeah. Well, in some of those instances, police need to be there because maybe the person might have a weapon or they might be violent. And sometimes there are domestic disputes going on, and for security reasons, you know, an officer needs to be there. But for the most part, I think it's true that the Seattle Police Department has hired mental health experts to assist in these calls. And those mental health experts, who are civilians, they're not sworn officers, have actually been really helpful. But as part of the transition to try to get the police to not be the first agency called or the first folks on the scene when someone's having a health or mental health crisis, there has to be data collected, and there has to be some kind of way to figure out how to differentiate the calls where you need a police officer from the calls where you don't. And so this is part of the data collection stuff that the Seattle Police Department has been doing, but also the monitor was looking at these calls to try to determine, is the Seattle Police Department improving in terms of use of force in crisis management calls? So, of course, before the meeting, right at the very beginning, as with all city council meetings now, there were public comments, and Howard Gale, who is a noted critic of the Seattle's police reform process.
And has been for many years.
Yeah, and he's great. He called in and he pointed out that the monitor's report that was being presented that day was based entirely on Seattle Police Department data from their dashboard that they've been collecting, and that it's not an independent or particularly reliable assessment of Seattle Police Department performance. That was Gale's assertion. And I have to say, having read the report, I can tell you that most of the paragraphs do begin with wording like, you know, SPD reported. Okay. So it does, he is right. It does rely on data that is reported by SPD officers themselves. So there really is no outside agency that, you know, rolls along with officers and collects this kind of data. It is all self-reported. So that is a good point. Now, the monitor
SPD has never been known to misrepresent anything.
Right. Now, the monitor responded to this assertion by Gale by saying that the previous monitor, Merrick Bob, and his team had worked really hard to get a data collection program in place to measure Seattle Police Department performance, and that data collection system is actually working very well, is what he asserted, and that it really didn't make sense to throw it out and start all over again with designing a new system and then trying to figure out who was going to be collecting the data. But then Lisa Herbold, who's the council member who chairs the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, she pointed out that both the Seattle Police Department and the monitor's report identify that there may be instances in which Seattle Police Department officers don't document their use of force during crisis interventions, and that they don't document that an incident was a crisis event. And reading the report, I can tell you that that's true. The monitor responded that all use of force is documented by the SPD, period. Then he said that some crisis events are not tagged as such when they're first entered into the system, but they get tagged later. But then he didn't explain how this relates to the requirement that Seattle Police Department officers fill out crisis contact paperwork for every person that they have a crisis interaction with. Okay, that's a requirement under the consent decree. They have to fill out that paperwork. If they don't tag an event as a crisis intervention event, then that paperwork doesn't get filled out. And he didn't respond. He didn't say anything about whether this paperwork gets filled out later, whether it's completely filled out later on when the event is tagged as a crisis event. He didn't say how much later those events are tagged. And whether or not that paperwork is actually accurate that much later after the fact. And he didn't say whether he was absolutely sure that there are no crisis events that fall through the cracks. Because the report says, quote, the statistics presented here must be interpreted with caution because both the monitoring team and SPD have identified some instances where a use of force may not have been properly documented as a crisis contact. For example, SPD's force review board has called for corrective action for missing crisis documentation for a few type 2 and type 3 uses of force, end quote. That's directly out of the report. Okay. And those are, and I should point out too that type 2 and type 3 uses of force are the more severe uses of force, up to and including shooting someone. Okay, or killing them in some other way. And the report goes on to say, quote, any use of force, whether it involves crisis documentation or not, results in a force investigation according to SPD policy, end quote, as if that's really the only thing that we need to be concerned about, right? Is that if there's a use of force, well, something's done about it, right? And in fact, the report does point out that, quote, SPD is planning to incorporate use of force reporting into its records management system, which already includes documentation of most SPD field activities like arrests and crisis contacts, end quote. So, okay, what that tells you is that they're not documenting use of force. Okay, period. There are interviews, right, and discussions by the force review board. And questioning by supervisors, et cetera, maybe recommendations, training, future training or whatever. But apparently no documentation actually happens. No standardized documentation happens when there's a use of force issue unless a civilian complains and the OPA decides to take up an investigation. That appears to be the case, right? And I have to say that's just whack.
But the OPA does not have subpoena power.
Right. And so, yeah, no, the OPA they can initiate investigations, but they tend not to. They tend to deal with, they tend to open an investigation when there's a complaint. And if, say, there's a person who doesn't have concerned relatives, who's gone through, maybe going through a mental health crisis, and there's a use of force that was improper, in their encounter with a police officer, if they, don't have the wherewithal to issue a complaint and nobody's gonna do it on their behalf, and there's no documentation of it, and it's not logged as a crisis, event when it first happens, you know, because there was a use of force, and, you know, maybe all that happened out of that use of force is that a supervisor interviewed the officer involved and closed it out and said, oh, nothing to worry about here, then that's a case that would fall through the cracks, right? So.
I know that Howard tweeted out this week. In fact, I'll read this to you. He was very critical, saying that SPD is killed during crisis are not in the database. He said, just verified and re-verified. This is a post from the 25th. All nine SPD killings of people in crisis since 5/15/2015, start of SPD crisis intervention database, are missing from that database.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's bad.
Because
it's bad.
Yeah, that's very bad. And that's partly because no paperwork was filled out at the beginning. You know, because there was a use of force, in that case, a type 3 use of force in which the person was killed, right? And according to the monitor, that's okay because those cases would have been internally investigated, which means that a supervisor would have questioned them. Maybe the force review board discussed it in a couple meetings, and the OPA was free to open an investigation if they wanted to, or if some person who was either the victim, well, the victim can't since they were killed, or someone who was related to them opened a complaint, or a witness opened a complaint. So according to the monitor, that's okay, but the fact that they're missing from the database is not okay. Okay. You know, and that's a big issue and a big lack here that I think the monitor should be on top of, but he's obviously not.
And the monitor being, again, one of the, like, four key oversight positions, supposedly.
Oh, yeah.
That the Seattle has.
And he's what the monitor does, he's appointed by Judge James Robart, who's overseeing the Seattle Police Department's coming into alignment with the consent decree with the Department of Justice. Okay. And the monitor is supposed to be the liaison between the city and the court, and he's supposed to get all of the different actors involved, from the police union to the city council to the Department of Justice, all on the same page and working together to try to and of course supervisors at the Seattle Police Department all together on the same page to try to work towards bringing the department into alignment with the consent decree. In this case, it looks to me like the monitor is just kind of letting things slide. At least this monitor is.
So there are a handful of cities that still have consent decrees that date back to the Obama administration.
Mm-hmm.
Seattle has been in reform process for a solid decade now.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if any cities have taken longer to reform themselves than Seattle.
Don't think so.
They have.
I think we're the one. Yeah.
But you have to conclude that the reform process is seriously broken if it's taken a solid decade and nothing still seems to be functioning in terms of the
right. Well, the Monitor is saying that things are better. That in terms of
whose testimony, the SPD's?
Well, yeah, based on the data on the SPD dashboard, and that's Gail's point. That the SPD and then the Monitor likes to point out, well, you know, at the start of the consent decree back in 2010 and 11, when the Department of Justice was investigating the Seattle Police Department, there was no data, you know, so there were just guesses that people had. And now we have data, and the data says that things are going better, you know.
Now we have bad data. That's an improvement.
Yeah, now we have data that's missing a lot of information, and that's not good. So just a reminder for folks, too, this report by the Monitor on crisis intervention by the Seattle Police Department is one of three reports that he'll be issuing, and it's currently on the website. You can go to the SeattlePoliceMonitor.org and read it there. It's one of three reports that the Monitor will be doing. It's in conjunction with community engagement meetings on each of these three reports. And the meeting for this one was held on January 11th. The next one will be on February 8th, and it'll be on stops and detentions, particularly looking at whether the Seattle Police Department is engaged in biased policing. And that's going to be a very, very important one. So that one, the community meeting is scheduled for February 8th. And last night when I checked, the Monitor had not posted the report for that one on the website yet. It's getting a little close to the meeting time. They need to get the report up there so people can read it. But as soon as they do, it's a good idea to go over there, read it, and comment. You can comment on the website if you can't attend the meeting, which is hosted by the Community Police Commission. Now, the third meeting is going to be on March 8th, and it's going to be on use of force. So all three of these are really, really important topics. And I encourage people who care about police accountability to keep an eye on the Seattle Police Monitor's website to read those reports when they're posted and comment on them and attend the meeting if you can. Now, the Monitor said that these documents and the public comments will be used to shape the Monitor's work plan for 2022. So I think it's very important to put your comments up there so that these issues don't just go away. Okay.
Yeah, very important. And as to whether they will incorporate any of that into their reports and into their long-term directions is another question. But being able to
getting those issues on the record is really important. And the more people who do that, the less likely they are to just kind of dismiss Howard Gale as a crank. Okay. So, you know, it's nice to have one guy who's looking at it and doing it. It's great when you have a whole community looking at it and say, hey, he's right. this is a problem.
Definitely.
So also at that same city council meeting of the Public Safety and Human Services Committee, right after the Monitor gave his presentation, the Office of Inspector General gave a presentation on a report that was released last year of their audit of the Seattle Police Department's internal disciplinary system. And we talked about that last year. It was one of my top stories of the year. That was the report that found that when the OPA, the Office of Police Accountability, recommends a range of disciplinary measures, the police chief, often in the city of Seattle, the police chief chooses the least severe form of discipline in nearly half of all cases, and in the majority of the remainder tends to choose sort of middle of the road discipline, and very, very seldom chose the most severe form of discipline. In addition, if a police chief decides to completely ignore the OPA's recommendations, he or she is not required to explain why, and they typically don't. Okay. And officers who were suspended and weren't supposed to be working at all were nevertheless still able to work overtime while suspended to make up for their lost pay, which kind of negates the whole purpose of a suspension as punishment or as discipline. So the Inspector General Lisa Judge and one of her lead researchers, Dan Pitts, presented the report to the City Council's Public Safety Committee. Okay. Dan Pitts did most of the presentation, and he started out by saying that there are gaps in the system and that no single gap breaks the system, but taken collectively points to a system that needs improvement. No kidding, right? And then he listed what he thought were the major gaps that could be discussed in the time that was allotted for the meeting. But there wasn't enough time to cover even those major gaps, much less the smaller gaps that are still significant enough to be included in this report. There was a very interesting back and forth between Councilmember Lisa Herbold and Dan Pitts regarding what should be classified as major gaps that the OIG issues a recommendation on versus less major gaps that the OIG discusses in the report but then doesn't issue a recommendation on. So she was asking, why didn't you issue a recommendation on these things? And I have to say, I was as confused as she was about this. Really, if something is worth highlighting, and you call it a major issue in your presentation, and it's on that list that you present as these are the major issues, then why didn't you issue a recommendation about it in the report? Yeah. So Pitts replied by saying, well, oh, these are outside our remit, okay? And we're highlighting them so that policy people can deal with them. In other words, we're shoving them over onto you, city council members, because I guess, I don't know, you guys can pass a law to force the Seattle Police Department to do them. And then Lisa Judge jumped in. She's the inspector general. She jumped in and she said that they weren't claiming there was a finding of fact about these things. They're just flagging them as issues of concern. And I was, at that point, I was kind of grabbing my hair going, what? If they're not fact-based, what are they doing in the report? Clearly, they're fact-based. Judges just being wishy-washy about what are really significant problems with SPD's internal disciplinary system. Okay. And it's really pointing to the fact that Inspector General Lisa Judge is unwilling to fulfill the role that the OIG, the Office of Inspector General, is supposed to be doing under the consent decree, which is overseeing that the reform process is successful. You know, she and Pitts pointed out that this is the first big look that the Office of the Inspector General has taken into the Seattle Police Department's internal disciplinary system, something that's been a decade in coming and been really, really important to do. But this is their first big look at it, and they're unearthing, it's like turning over a rock and seeing a whole lot of bugs scatter. They're unearthing a whole lot of problems. And rather than saying, wow, okay, we have a big mess to clean up and it needs to happen and happen soon, they're saying, well, you know, we're going to pick and choose some things. Some things we'll make recommendations on. Other things we'll just let them go. But we're going to highlight them in case, you know, other people want to do something about them, but we don't want to make a big stink. You know, I mean, that's being wishy-washy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I thought this report was an example, example of how they have been watering down their role in the police reform process.
And yep. it's a really good example too of an interaction between, an oversight body within the city of Seattle and the city council. Mm-hmm. And the way it's being framed, it's given, you know, a relatively short amount of council time, which mm-hmm. also means that, you know, citizens can tune in and watch this and see the recording actually that took place. Mm-hmm. And it tends to get down into, the phrases that they use, which are really, terminology that is unfriendly to people that might be tuning in and unfamiliar with the particular issue.
I mean, the video is boring. I have to tell you that watching some of these city council committee meetings can be very boring, right? If you're not familiar with the terminology, or you're not following what they're actually talking about, or you haven't read the document ahead of time, or you're not following along, it can, or you don't know the background, it can be very, very dull. And in fact, I kind of wondered about some of the other council members who were present, because it was only Councilmember Herbold who really asked questions and talked with both the monitor and with Pitts and Judge from the OIG's office. And there were other council members there, Sarah Nelson, Alex Peterson, Andrew Lewis. There were other folks there, but none of them really asked questions. I think Sarah Nelson asked one question, but it was incoherent, and everybody just kind of like, yeah, whatever, you know, kind of cutting her slack for being new, you know. Mm-hmm. And Alex Peterson gave a little speech there about how important public safety is, and I was just kind of like, yeah, okay, get over yourself. But it's like, yeah, we know it's important. Okay, let's get to the business at hand, you know.
Yeah, stop eating up time.
Yeah.
So there's going to be two public meetings coming up
based on the monitors. Yeah, the monitors activity regarding giving us all updates on what the monitor thinks is going on with the police reform process based on data from the SPD. The important question is that data complete? And what is, and can we trust it? And I think it's important to note that it isn't complete.
Yeah, the answer to that is no and no, respectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we can trust the data on incidents. I think we can trust the data on the minor incidents that are documented. It's just that what's not there. And it appears that the very serious stuff that we really need oversight of is what's not there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess I'm not entirely convinced that the data on the minor incidents is accurate either. It would be nice to have. We really need an outside, you know, set of eyes that can look at this.
Oh, I don't feel like filling out all that paperwork.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's.
Well, I think what's really important here is that we need civilians working on some of these calls, not SPD, not necessarily a person with a gun going to every crisis management call, every, you know, yeah, crisis intervention call. I think that's the big takeaway here, is that you get outside eyes in there when you have civilians who are willing to, who have training and can work on these issues with people, and service providers who can get in there and help people who are in crisis too.
Well, let's move on, because inevitably we'll be hearing more about
oh, yes, we will.
Police issues later. King County Regional Homeless Authority.
Yeah. Publicola reported this week that the King County Regional Homelessness Authority will in fact be doing an in-person point-in-time count of the homeless this year. It's going to be in March, after all. A spokesperson for the agency acknowledged that the count would be a point-in-time count for HUD purposes. So it appears that the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development is, after all, requiring the King County Regional Homelessness Authority to do an in-person count this year, even though the count was suspended last year because of COVID-19. Back in December, CEO Mark Dones of the King County Regional Homelessness Authority had initially said that the agency would skip doing the in-person count in 2022 too, because HUD only requires a count in odd numbered years, and 2022 is an even numbered year. But at the same time, Publicola noted that other county and municipal agencies were in Washington State were in fact planning on doing counts in 2022, and that King County appeared to be on its own in regards to not doing that count, and that by missing doing that count, the King County was in fact accepting that they would be penalized when applying for federal money, because federal grants are awarded based on a points system, and you lose points when you don't do an in-person count as usual every other year. Now it appears that someone from the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development has actually clarified that situation for Doan's, and Doan's has made the decision that that the agency will in fact be doing the in-person count. Now, back in December, the King County Regional Homelessness Authority said that the in-person count was unreliable because data from the King County Department of Community and Human Services estimates that over 40,000 people are homeless in King County. That's a number that's more than three times higher than the previous point in time count, any point in time count that's been done in the past.
Yeah, the most recent of which was 2 years ago.
Yeah, now that's... pandemic. Yeah, now that's a number that was extrapolated, that 40,000 was extrapolated from data about how many households needed help from various service agencies provided within the county, with an effort to try and eliminate overlap. Not sure how accurate that effort was. But without a by name list, we can't know for sure exactly how accurate that process was in coming up with the 40,000 number. Now, it's likely that the federal Department of Housing and Urban Development was deeply concerned about the King County Regional Homelessness Authority wanting to use this new, much higher number to apply for federal funding. And so they demanded that the agency do an in-person count instead. That would be my guess when the King County Regional Homelessness Authority said, hey, you know, we're not doing the point in time count. We want much more accurate data. We have this data from the King County, from King County, Human Services that is much higher. We're going to go with that number. And it's more than three times higher than the old number that the feds went. What? Wait.
Which really underscores that so much of homelessness policy in Seattle and now in King County.
Yeah.
Have to do with agencies trying to get funding. They don't actually have to do with providing services. Building housing that is affordable, that people can move into off the street. This has been a game that these agencies have been playing for 20, 30 years now. And things haven't improved. They've gotten worse because we don't have affordable housing to move people into. But that would require spending money on housing, and our local governments don't really seem to be willing to do that.
Well, this is pretty much the first year that the city has been able to allocate, almost a couple hundred million dollars for affordable housing, and it takes time to build housing. Okay, it also takes time to build shelters, particularly shelters with services that can help people get their lives stabilized and ready to go into permanent housing. I've been reading the city council emails and, blog posts and stuff that they put that the different city council members put out. And one of the ones that I found quite interesting this week was Dan Strauss's. And in the email, he talks about things he accomplished last year. One of the things that he brags about is getting the homeless encampment cleared out of Ballard Commons without doing a sweep. And what he doesn't say is that the reason that homeless encampment, reason people were able to leave that homeless encampment is because a whole bunch of shelter beds happened to open at the same time. And so there were suddenly all these shelter beds available. Those folks went in and helped to fill up their shelter beds, but that's not happening for a whole bunch of other encampments around the city. It takes time and it takes a lot of money to open new shelter beds as well as to build new housing. There's so many people sleeping in encampments and in their vehicles around the city that the county. That opening a new shelter bed for every single one of them is just going to be really, really difficult and be really, really expensive.
Yeah, and the response to people living in their vehicles is still highly inadequate.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to this week's developments with the COVID pandemic.
Well, there's some good news, which is that number of new cases from the Omicron variant have been declining now for the last several weeks in both King and Pierce County. The bad news, you knew there was bad news to go with it, is that they are exploding in eastern Washington. So the numbers are actually somewhat stable statewide. The numbers are also becoming increasingly difficult to track because for some reason the State Department of Health has decided to report new data only 3 times a week. And as somebody who tracks the data from every state, not just Washington state, you're seeing that in a handful of states, Ohio and Florida, for example, only report deaths once a week. But those are Republican states that have an interest in downplaying the data. It's not clear why Washington state is going to, Monday, Wednesday, Friday reporting, which make it very difficult to separate out, what the daily cases are. One possible explanation is that they are so backlogged with reports from different hospital districts around the state that the day-to-day data simply isn't reliable, that you have to look at the 7-day averages. And that's increasingly what health departments are doing, not just here, but everywhere. So nationally, Omicron continues to increase. We now have over 3,000 deaths per day in the United States. In other words, we're getting a 9/11 every day. And those deaths are entirely preventable. They're almost all among unvaccinated people. That being said, you need to continue wearing masks, continuing doing social distancing, and continue washing your hands. Omicron survives longer on surfaces, we now know, than previous variants did. So we're back to the early days of the pandemic when it's a good idea to wash surfaces and wash your hands often. So that's what's going on the pandemic front. The pandemic is still alive and well, and we're not through it yet. There is some indication that, case numbers will subside over the next several weeks, maybe between now and early March, but we're not there yet. And if we reach the peak, that means we've got half the cases on the other side. So continue to be cautious just a while longer, hopefully.
Yeah, and I would recommend, too, that whether you're vaccinated or not, I've been seeing some restaurants in my neighborhood are still kind of practicing social distancing where people are seated at tables far apart from each other. But I'm also seeing many restaurants that are packed where people are elbow to elbow. No one's wearing a mask, eating and drinking. And I just think that that's probably the best way to spread Omicron. I would wait a month at least before going back to a crowded restaurant or bar. Just wait a month for Omicron to die down a bit. And let's not forget that young people can spread it to older people who have a much more serious reaction to the virus, and that is what's stressing our hospitals. And we want to make sure that our hospitals are able to handle people who have other health issues that need to be treated on an emergency basis and not just people with COVID-19.
Yeah. And Southern Idaho entered a crisis of care status this week in 18 counties for precisely that reason, because the hospitals are just crowded with unvaccinated Omicron patients, and it's preventing.
Yeah, I keep reading about people in their 40s and 50s, still fairly young, who are passing away from cancer. Some of them have had cancer for many years, but others are reaching a level of pain, going to their doctor when it's an emergency, and suddenly they have untreatable cancer that could have been picked up earlier because they just, have been staying away because doctors are overwhelmed, hospitals are overwhelmed, people are not getting their regular screenings for things. I think it's very important that we all, if we can, schedule our regular screenings, that we do that and not allow fear of the virus to keep us from getting the healthcare that we need. But that also means that folks who are vaccinated and boosted and want to get on with their life, just please be careful about where you go and make sure you wear a mask.
Yeah, particularly, indoor spaces, especially indoor spaces with poor ventilation that are small and crowded. That's a danger sign. And some of the bars that I've seen around town where people are, as Maria said, elbow to elbow in you know, small spaces that probably don't have good ventilation.
Yeah, talking, laughing, and one place doing karaoke, you know, that with you know, no mask, no protections, or at a maybe indoor sporting event, cheering loudly. I mean, those are kind of things that I would avoid for a little while at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, didn't
not that Marie and I spend all our time going from bar to bar. But
purely for bar, data collection.
Yeah, the bars in my neighborhood are on my walk in between work and home, and they have big windows to be inviting people in. And I peer in, and I'm like, oh my God, that bar is packed. That restaurant is packed. Every table is taken up with two or three people at every table. They're elbow to elbow. The only people wearing masks are the waiters and waitresses. I'm just like, oh, that's terrible. Just give it a month, at least.
Didn't Jay Inslee dispatch National Guard to hospitals like 2 weeks ago?
Yeah,
yes, he did.
And we need to be aware of that. And people are just, I think it's COVID fatigue. People are just wanting to get on with their lives. You know, they've heard that Omicron is not as severe, and you know, they've had three shots now, and they're ready to party.
Yeah, and although the percentage of people who've had booster shots is still shockingly low. It's in the 20% range.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. What was that? It's in the 20% range?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and that surprises me. I mean, you know, we're well over 80%, approaching 90% of people in King County vaccinated. People here need to just go get your booster shot.
Yep. Can we do a mention of this week in celebrity COVID news? Sarah Palin has tested positive. She, of course, almost single-handedly launched the modern version of stupid conservatism. And she continued to go out to New York City restaurants unmasked after she was tested positive. So she's been spreading it as well. And there's the spat between different rock stars and Spotify that was launched this week when Neil Young said, okay, Spotify, you can have Joe Rogan or you can have me, my music. You can't have both. If you're not going to drop Joe Rogan, you know, you need to pull my music. And Spotify said, okay, and pulled his music because they have too many viewers for Joe Rogan. They don't want to drop that. And then
Rogan has been spreading, hosting anti-vax, quote unquote, medical experts on his show. And that's what sparked the comment from Neil Young.
Notorious purveyor of misinformation. Mm-hmm. So since then, Joni Mitchell and Peter Frampton have also hopped on that bandwagon. It mostly seems to be the veterans of the 60s who were interested in doing this. But
keep in mind, those are older folks too. You know, folks who are most likely to get very, very ill if they get COVID-19. And they're basically saying to younger folks that, hey, you know, we don't want you out there spreading the virus. Don't listen to this guy.
Yeah. And the first two, Neil Young and Joni Mitchell, are originally Canadian. Maybe that has something to do with it too.
Mm-hmm.
But, interestingly enough, you know, people are going, well, you know, the artists don't really get any income out of, Spotify. They're not losing anything, and Spotify's not losing anything because they're hanging on to Joe Rogan. Well, the last part of that statement is not correct because Spotify lost $4 billion in stock valuation last week as a result of this kerfuffle. So, you know, they are definitely taking a hit as a result of this, because of the bad PR and the bad PR of their decision to stick with the misinformation rather than, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame musicians. So it'll be interesting to see if other musicians also jump on that bandwagon, and some of the more contemporary musicians as well, people who have had hits in more recent decades, shall we say. Something to keep an eye on in future weeks.
All right. So, Stephen Breyer announcing his coming retirement this week.
Yeah, and that, of course, immediately set off a firestorm of speculation as to who the new Supreme Court justice might be. President Biden has stated emphatically that the next nominee that he makes will be a African-American woman, which will be a first for the Supreme Court. There have been 115 white men in the history of the Supreme Court, and exactly 5 women and exactly 2 African Americans. So, yeah, it's well past time. And there are a number of qualified candidates. It's worth pointing out that in recent decades, every single nominee to the Supreme Court has gone to an elite private college, both for undergraduate and for graduate and for law school. So, you know, look for that particular qualification among people who are nominated. It would be nice to have somebody stand up for public education, but that hasn't been happening in a long, long time. This will not change the balance of the Supreme Court, at least not initially. It will still be 6-3 since Breyer was considered a liberal justice. He was actually fairly moderate and had a history of trying to find consensus, which of course, you know, really is kind of an outdated concept at this point. He was a Clinton nominee.
I think there are a number of us who are hoping that Biden would try to find someone who would be a good replacement for Justice Ginsburg, since that was not happen when Amy Coney Barrett.
It didn't.
Yeah. It would be nice to see a woman of color who also would stand up for a woman's right to choose, for women's rights in general, and who would be a bit more progressive than Amy Coney Barrett and Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, the Trump.
That's a very low bar, especially on women's rights.
Yeah. It would be nice to have a judge who had a public education as well, and maybe had some experience of poverty in their youth, or some idea of how the rest of us live.
Well, fingers crossed on that.
Fingers crossed, yeah. And we'll see. We'll see what the Biden administration comes up with. Biden has promised that he would have it would be a very quick process, and he would have a nominee by the end of February.
Yes. And then they're hoping to get through Congress the following month.
Yeah.
You know, within a month, similar to the Coney Barrett timeline.
Yeah.
Moving on, developments this week with the January 6th committee.
Yeah. Yesterday, I think it was, the January 6th committee issued 14 new subpoenas. You've never heard of any of the names, but they're highly significant. They are the chairs and the secretaries of the organizations that signed the fake electoral certifications in 7 different swing states in 2020. Now, this is, apparently was part of the scheme that was intended to keep Donald Trump in office. It failed when those fake certifications were rejected by the National Archives as forgeries. But it raises the question of who exactly organized that in 7 different states? Who gave the orders to bring that together? And that's why these people are being subpoenaed.
Who coordinated all that? That sounds like a conspiracy to me, a real conspiracy, not a fake conspiracy.
Yeah. I mean, in the sense of it requires a bunch of people acting in concert to do it. And you would have to think that the orders for that came from the top. The details may have been thought up by different minions, but, all of that would have had to have been approved by Donald Trump.
Yeah. And, last week there was news that the January 6th committee was able to get their hands on those records from the White House that Donald Trump had been trying to keep away from them. The Supreme Court finally just said, nope, those are a matter of public record. The National Archives needs to provide those to the January 6th committee. And even if you were the sitting president right now, those records would need to be provided to the January 6th committee.
And they have been. Mm-hmm. And not only that, but the chief of staff to Mark Meadows, who was in turn the chief of staff to Donald Trump, testified for several hours behind closed doors with the committee this week and reportedly did not invoke the Fifth Amendment at any point. So that would have had to been juicy, because that's the kind of position outside the public eye that would play a key coordination role in any kind of conspiracy like that.
Yeah, now, in addition to, I believe just in the last week or two, the January 6th committee managed to get their hands on 28 devices that were owned by Rudy Giuliani, Donald Trump's legal counsel at the time, and a man that most people think may have been key in organizing this whole thing. Maybe not the guy to do it, but someone who probably played a big role in helping to coordinate it. And I remember looking at that thinking, who has 28 electronic devices sitting around their home?
Somebody who has a supply of burner phones, that's who.
Yes, yes. Or else they have a big staff working out of their home, not out of their office, but working out of their home as a sideline to coordinate some big national campaign, right?
Yeah. So, or they'd outsource it to the Ukraine.
Well, yeah, or whatever. But we'll see what comes of what the January 6th committee is able to salvage from those devices.
Yeah, and you're hearing statements. Of course, committee members can't really talk about what they've heard so far.
Yeah.
But they can characterize the nature of it. And we're getting statements from Chair Bernie Thompson, Jamie Raskin, a couple other people had statements out this week, Adam Schiff, saying that, you know, when this is all made public, it's going to blow the doors off Washington, D.C.
Wow.
So we'll see whether that's the case or not, but, man, I can hardly wait.
Some juicy stuff in the works, for sure.
Yep, yep, yep.
Hey, and Rudy Giuliani is scheduled to be the keynote speaker at the King County Republican Party fundraiser in March. So that's probably going to be a fun event.
Oh, good. Let's organize for that now.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to be charging a lot of money per ticket. Otherwise, I'd want to go. But I'm not paying enough money.
They're actually going. We have to figure out which landscaping company they're going to hold it in front of.
Right, and then we can all go with signs and chant.
Yep.
Well, I suspect even if he can't get into the event, it'll still be probably a welcoming committee on the outside. So,
I expect so. I believe the technical phrase is gauntlet.
Yeah.
All right. Well, unfortunately, I think we are out of time.
I think we are.
Yes, we are.
So we'll have to talk about the Pittsburgh collapse and then infrastructure next week. And a harrowing story out of Nashville, also a copy-eating Padlet. We'll get to that next week, too.